have to go out on the road and do every different type of show there is. The one for 30 drunk Harley Davidson guys at a VFW. The ladies' lunch at the Carlisle. The Christmas party for firemen. The ferry that circles Manhattan. And the comedy festival in Staten Island. You have to do all of it, or you will plateau and go nowhere. Which is fine, if that is what you want to do. I would do anything for stage time. Actually, let me rephrase that. I have never hooked up with anyone to get ahead in the business. If anything, some people I've dated have set me back. One time my sister overheard one of the bouncers that I've known since I started stand-up say, "Amy's gotten so much work. Wonder how she got it." Then he mimed a dick going into his mouth. I guess I should be angry about this kind of thing, but it couldn't be further from the truth. I've never gotten anything from anyone I've hooked up with, not even a Starbucks gift card, which would have been nice. During the week between road gigs when I was home in New York, I began performing at the Comedy Cellar. That's the club you see on the show Louie and in lots of documentaries about comics. I was passed there in 2007, which means I got to audition for the booker. I don't know the origin of this terminology, but only in the comedy world would people use such a morbid verb to signify the best thing that could happen to your career. Anyway, if the booker likes you, then they ask you to provide your availability for doing shows. If they don't like you, they say no thanks. I auditioned at the Cellar on my birthday. And Esty, who's been the booker there forever, gave me the phone number to call in my avails. And I lost my mind. I was so excited. I remember celebrating that night and getting so drunk that I got a piggyback ride from the bouncer at the bar and spent most of the night riding around back and forth, laughing and singing. There's a restaurant upstairs from the Comedy Cellar called the Olive Tree Cafe, and there is a booth in the back reserved for comedians. I was hesitant to sit there for years. Once I did, I'd stay quiet. Eventually, over time, I got more and more comfortable, and now it's the place I feel most at home in the whole world, sitting around the table with my best friends. I'm happiest when the table consists of Jimmy Norton, Keith Robinson, Colin Quinn, Rachel Feinstein, and Bobby Kelly. And sometimes we can convince Bridget Everett to stop by. We all trash each other, eat wings, and laugh. When someone dies or gets hurt, we cry and laugh again. Doing stand-up and being with comics is home for me. Yes, it was completely thrilling to get my own TV show and to write and star in a movie. But getting on stage to do live comedy will always be what I chase harder than anything else. Eventually, all my work on the road landed me some specials for TV. I had a half-hour special in Comedy Central in 2010, and then an hour special, mostly sex stuff, in 2012. Through all of this, I stayed on the road, always touring, always writing more jokes. This is the only way to get better. I started selling more tickets in the clubs, and then small theaters, and then large theaters that seated about 900 people, just like in the semifinals of Last Comic Standing. The skills I developed from doing so much stand-up are the same ones I needed to write a movie and play a lead character who was based on myself. My having been on stage all these years with so many eyes on me as I degrade myself nightly is the reason my pulse doesn't change when internet trolls try to ruin my day. Every other day. One of the things I'm still most proud of is my one-hour HBO special, Amy Schumer Live at the Apollo, and the fact that I got to work with Chris Rock as the director. I never would have been able to work with him if I hadn't been brave enough to ask. We'd been friendly for years, seeing each other at the Comedy Cellar, but I never wanted to bother him. Because he is Chris Rock. Then one night we talked after we'd both performed on Night of Too Many Stars, an event to raise money for autism. My set had been strong, and Chris stopped by the green room and offered to help me if I ever needed it. Which sounds creepy, but it's not. He said exactly what he meant. When you have the disease of being a comic, and you see someone else with some talent and respect for comedy, you want to help. It's in his veins. It's in my veins. A little later, I called his bluff, which was anything but. He started riding around and going to clubs with me to watch my set, give me notes, and help me get better. One day, I just bit the bullet and texted him, "Will you direct my HBO special?" Again, this is the kind of confidence you can only get after years of making a clown of yourself on stage and being met with crickets. When Chris said yes, I couldn't believe it. He came on the road with me and made my set 1,000 times better. Getting to work on jokes with him felt like my make-a-wish. I know that's not a kind comparison to make, but there is nothing else I can think of that would communicate how significant this time was to me. One of the greatest moments of my career was hosting Saturday Night Live. I'm sure a lot of stand-ups dream of doing that opening SNL monologue. I know I have since I was a little girl. You write, rehearse, and perform the show in 1 week. That's all you get. One surreal, supercharged week to live your dream. 1 week to rush around the crowded hallways in that historic building. Nothing in my career has felt more exciting. But I won't lie, it was a grueling 7 days. One that can definitely be described as athletic. You barely sleep, you constantly eat, well, I did, and you do nothing all week but write, rewrite, rehearse, try on wigs, get sewn into costumes, film promos, post for photo shoots, rewrite, consider showering, choose sleepover showering, do table reads, rehearse, and repeat. And on the night of the show itself, you are literally running or rushing for the entire hour and a half. Stand-up comedy is live performance, sure, but SNL is live performance on meth. By Saturday night, I was definitely the walking wounded, but I'd never been happier. My very favorite scene was one that Vanessa Bayer and Mikey Day wrote about two overly chipper flight attendants, played by me and Vanessa, who sing the in-flight service announcements before they are suddenly sucked out of the plane one at a time. Live television doesn't allow for stunt doubles, so Vanessa and I had to actually hurl ourselves out of this plane door in order to make the scene work. I am a clown at heart, and my competitive volleyball pass didn't hurt, so I had no problem going for it. But Vanessa was a little more tentative. I wanted nothing more than to open the entire show with this sketch, so I grabbed her by the shoulders and I said, "Vanessa, we are going to have to hurt ourselves, okay?" After rehearsing several times, we both felt pretty confident about the stunt. But then on Friday, the set builders moved the airplane onto a platform, which in turn lowered the clearance of the door we were jumping through by a full 8 inches. No problem, I thought, stupidly confident. Vanessa was up first to try jumping through the new door, and she did it, perfectly. But when it was my turn, I bricked my head right into the door. Everyone gasped as I lay on the mat, unmoving. My first thought was, I will have to do this show with scabs all over my face and a bump on my forehead. My second thought was, let's do this fucking thing again. We have to get it right. By this point in my career, I'd become a pro at falling face first and getting up stronger. They iced my face and gave me some Advil, and we rehearsed it a dozen more times. I went harder every time. I flew through that door and smashed into that mat, and it was worth it. My shoulder hurt for 4 months after, but that scene is my favorite sketch I've ever put on tape. After being on one of the most historic stages and having the best night a comic could have in front of a live audience of millions, I woke up the next morning, ready to get back on the road. My episode of Saturday Night Live and my HBO special aired within 7 days of each other. So getting back on the road was more important than ever. I burned all my jokes on those two events, meaning they'd aired on TV to massive audiences, so I couldn't use them anymore because people would know them now. Unlike musicians, comedians are expected to always bring new shit. No one wants to hear the greatest hits, so I was back to square one. This requirement of comedy is exhausting and challenging, but I wouldn't have it any other way. It's exciting and humbling to have to start over, and the payoff is even better. You feel so accomplished when you've accumulated enough material, one joke at a time, for an entire special. And when you're back to zero, it doesn't matter who you are. You're starting the fuck over. It's the scariest, emptiest feeling in the world. Even the greatest, most seasoned comics are afraid they'll never write a great joke again. But you do the work. And that means hitting the road and getting on stage. I know I'm repeating myself, but it's my number one piece of advice to comics who are just starting out when they ask me how to become successful. Get on stage. If there isn't a comedy room in your town, produce one. Find a place with a stage and a mic and stand in front of people as much as possible. Log as many hours as you can. I still do this. I'm not bullshitting you. The money is good now, but even on my off nights, I am still on stage in shitty little rooms, rock clubs, jazz halls, wherever. Always working hard to get better. I became obsessed a long time ago, and it has never dulled. No matter how hard you work or how sharp you keep yourself, your popularity and ticket sales will ebb and flow. But I'm very proud to say that right now, as I write this in 2016, I'm touring arenas, doing stand-up for crowds of 10 to 15,000 people. I'm telling jokes where NBA and NHL games are played. I sold out Madison Square Garden. I can't believe I just typed that. For these arena shows, I have the same opening comic, Mark Normand, with whom I've worked with the past 7 years. My brother, Jason, also opens the show with his jazz trio, which means I get to hang out on the road with his wife, Casey, who is one of my best friends and helped edit this book. Their daughter, my niece, hangs out backstage with us. Sometimes my sister Kim and her husband Vinny are there too. I get to stay in nice hotels and have a tour bus or fly first class or sometimes even travel via private jet. I feel extremely lucky, and I know better than to get too comfortable or think it will last forever. But I love every minute of it right now. It feels so great to walk out on stage after Mark says my name, to hug him and look at the crowd and give them everything I've got. I vow every night before I go on to do the best show I've ever done. I still bomb. I still kill. Either way, the crowd will let you know the truth. It's masochistic, and it's noble, and I never want to stop. Times it's okay for a man not to make a woman come during sex. 1. If she's a hooker and the next guy is waiting. But even then, check with her. 2. If she's in a rush and tells you she doesn't have time. 3. If you're on an airplane or anywhere in public, if you get away with having sex in public, get in and get out. But make sure you take care of her when you get home. 4. If you realize that your kids or parents will walk into the room. But again, take care of her later. 5. If she gets a cramp or if she gets hungry. Note: it is okay to not make a woman come during sex if you made her come before it. I am someone who can't really come from penetration, so I hope you enjoy a nice visit with my clit before the main event. The worst night of my life. Here we go. It's time to tell you about Dan, who has already come up in this book. I thought he was the love of my life for a long time, but I allowed him to hurt me in ways that I still don't understand. I met him when I was 18 years old, and I liked him right away. He'd take his clothes off for no reason and run around without shame. We had a lot in common, especially the shameless nudity part. I think nudity has the potential to be both beautiful and hilarious. So when given the chance, I pull a Porky Pig on my TV show. Which basically means that whenever a scene allows, I'll rock out in a long boyfriend shirt with no pants or underwear. Anyway, Dan wasn't interested in a relationship with me, and I pretended I wasn't interested in one with him either. Dan was fascinating to me. He grew up in Manhattan in an incredible loft and got shipped off to boarding school at 13. He was a bad kid. Lots of detention and sex. New York City kids don't really drink underage like Long Island kids. Instead, they do drugs and bang each other to feel like adults. He effed any girl who would hold still long enough for him to come. Or at least that's how he described it to me. But bad kid or not, I felt he was misunderstood and that I was the one person who could really love him. Which, as you know by now, was my cup of tea through most of my 20s. The first night I slept with him was at his mom's place in NYC. The apartment was incredible, huge with high ceilings and decorated impeccably. There was so much about him and his home that was cool to me. It was cool that at night when he came downstairs to let me in the building, he was barefoot and in his underwear. Barefoot on the pavement in Manhattan? It was cool he had a Dexter Gordon poster in his room. And it was cool that he knew about art. His family friends were famous, culturally elite people. This was thrilling to me. I wanted no part of my suburban upbringing anymore, and I was smitten with him and the life he was projecting. I knew we were meant to be together, but he wasn't convinced that I was the girl for him. Maybe it was because the only poster I had in my room was of Ani DiFranco, and if you asked me who our family friends were, I would have said the Muppets. Or maybe it was just that Dan was a real don't-want-to-join-any-club-that-would-have-me-as-a-member type of guy. But I was playing the long game, and I took my time winning him over. I even drove him cross-country when he moved to the West Coast. We were 20 years old, driving a U-Haul across America, and by the time we got to Vegas, he was mine. I could feel the shift in him when I'd finally worn him down. He could see the look in my eyes, which said, "You are mine, bro." We were together, and we were running low on money, but he still decided to buy a pair of Gucci sunglasses from an outlet store. Red flag? I chose not to notice those sort of fun little quirks. I thought that because his parents were rich, he was rich. This was a puzzle I didn't fully solve until a year later when I was living with him and had to peddle that horrible pedicab around town so we had grocery money, which he proceeded to spend on alcohol. And yes, when we were still in Vegas, he screamed at me at the top of his lungs and shook me so hard that I had to run and hide until he calmed down. It was the first time I saw this behavior from him. I'd never seen him even a little upset before. And how did I reward that behavior? I moved in with him a year later. We lived together for one summer on the West Coast when I was just 21. We had an apartment up on a hill and very close to the beach. Every day, I'd wake up early and teach a kickboxing class at the Y, then go play in a female volleyball doubles league, then meet up with him and drink and fight and fuck. It was everything you could want. If what you want is Penelope Cruz and Javier Bardem's relationship in Vicky Cristina Barcelona. And if you didn't see that movie, I was the Whitney to his Bobby. Quick shout out, I loved Whitney so much, and I still can't believe she's gone. Anyway, Dan and I would go to happy hours with friends and get drunk, and then he'd get mad at me and shove me a little. Sometimes, from the shove, I'd trip over something and fall and get hurt. But of course it was an accident. I got hurt by accident a lot that year. He'd get jealous about something I did and would squeeze my arm too hard, and I'd get a horrible bruise. But of course, it was an accident, and he always felt terrible afterward. I'd comfort him, and we'd move on until the next time it happened. But it's not like I was in an abusive relationship, right? I mean, I wasn't a passive girl. I've been easily standing up for myself for as long as I could talk. I'm the girl who would bully the bullies in middle school, defend the kids who got made fun of. I'd always prided myself on being strong, assertive, and independent. It couldn't happen to me, right? On a regular basis, Dan would say things to me I didn't let anyone else say. Passively hurtful things to let me know I wasn't as pretty as the other women he'd dated. He'd point out areas of my legs and arms and stomach he thought I needed to work on. He'd pull the shower curtain open and laugh at my naked body. Once he even pissed on my legs and feet while laughing. I'd cry and go for a walk, and we'd start over. But come on. I was smart and funny and a loudmouth who spoke her mind. I definitely wasn't in an abusive relationship, right? That only happens to girls who don't believe in themselves, right? It proceeded to get worse and worse, and I started escaping the apartment whenever I could. I'd go to Starbucks, lock myself in the bathroom, and sit on the floor and cry. I knew I should go back to the East Coast, but I thought no one would ever love me as much as he did. I believed he was just as passionate about me as I was about him. And that if I did a better job of not making him mad, we'd be fine. I really felt he loved me, and I really loved him. I think somewhere in the course of our relationship, I started to confuse his anger and aggression for passion and love. I actually started to think that real love was supposed to look like that. The more you yelled at each other, the more you loved each other. The more physical and demeaning it got, the more you were really getting through to each other. And the more I was willing to stand by him, the more he'd understand I truly loved him and that we should be together forever. And he always felt so bad about what he'd done after he shouted or bruised me. Surely he wouldn't beat himself up so much if he didn't love me so much. It's not abusive if they feel really bad afterward and promise to love you the rest of your life, right? Right? Wrong. Knowing what I know now, it's clear as day, of course, and being frightened and hurt and abused isn't reserved for insecure women who are easily intimidated. Or women who came from unstable environments. Or women who have never seen a positive male role model. I learned from a TED Talk about domestic violence by Leslie Morgan Steiner. These are mostly her words. That women of all income and education levels are affected. I also learned that I was a typical domestic violence victim because of my age. In the United States, women ages 16 to 24 are 3 times more likely to be domestic violence victims than women of any other age. Also, every year in the United States, 500 women in this age bracket are killed by their domestic abuser. A domestic abuser doesn't just have to be someone you live with. It means anyone you are in an intimate relationship with. I was a statistic. What made things so confusing with Dan was that we usually had the best time. We were manic together. He was obsessed with me in a way that made me feel high. We had sex several times a day. I thought it was because I turned him on so much. But I now believe it was because it was a way for him to have my undivided attention. We'd laugh until we were in tears, fuck, pledge our undying love, and then the next moment, we'd be in shouting turmoil and he'd be screaming at me and squeezing me too hard. One humid summer night, we went out with our friends to a new bar. We were all dressed up and excited to get into the new hotspot. I love dancing, always have, always will. Am I good at it? Nope. But that has never stopped me. I grabbed my girlfriend, and we hit the floor. Sometimes Dan would dance, but on this evening, I think because I had talked all day about how excited I was, he wanted to sour it a little. I dance like all other white girls in a sexually suggestive way that says, this is what it would be like to mount me. It's completely false advertising. Also, I don't do it well. And over the years, several black people have pointed this out to me, to my face. Anyway, my girlfriend and I were gyrating and body rolling on the dance floor when out of nowhere, Dan came up and grabbed my arm. He didn't like how the guys in the bar were looking at me, and he thought I was flirting with them. I left the dance floor, and we drank and drank, and kissed in a booth, and then the song Real Love by Mary J. Blige came on. And you know I had to dance to that. It's like a law that all women turn into the Manchurian Candidate when that song comes on. A guy came up to me on the dance floor who I would have bet my life was gay. We sang the song and danced together. We were giggling and half grinding, but made no actual contact. It was totally innocent. Dan walked past me on the floor on his way to the bathroom and whispered in my ear, "You're disgusting." I was furious. I thought, "I'll show you disgusting," and began to dance very sexually with another guy on the floor. When Dan came out of the bathroom, he again dragged me to the booth. And that was when I did something that I'd never done before and never ever will do again. I spit right in his face. I don't know if I thought I was a character in West Side Story or if it was just the booze that gave me major balls, but I did it. And this maneuver awakened the beast in Dan and fired off my fear signal in one instant. He got a look in his eye that scared the shit out of me, and I ran. I ran right out the door of the bar, and I kept running. I ran to our friend's house down the street, but he caught up to me. I tried to calm him down, and I told him that it was probably better if we spent the night apart to cool off. That was the smart thing to do. And he was smart, so I was sure he'd agree. Maybe call me a bitch, then storm away, right? No. The smart thing did not happen. Instead, when I got out my phone to call my friend, he grabbed it out of my hand and whipped it at a nearby tree, where it shattered. He put his hands on my cheeks and squeezed my face so hard, my head was throbbing, and I could tell this night was different. I wasn't safe, and I knew it. I told him I was going to walk to my friend's house and asked him to leave me alone. He wouldn't. He followed me. My heart was pounding while I listened to his footsteps behind me on the quiet side streets. I kept walking and walking, and then for a second I didn't hear his footsteps. But it was too late when I realized he was right behind me. I tried to pick up the pace, and this pissed him off, and he pushed me onto the hood of a parked car. I banged my head and my elbow hard. This was more than he'd done before. This was an actual violent outburst. I didn't get hurt by accident this time. He saw the car right there and pushed me onto it intentionally. I burst into tears, kicked off my shoes, and ran down the street as fast as I could, listening to my own breath, trying to slow down my heart rate like my volleyball coach had taught me. I think Dan had surprised himself. I heard voices coming from a nearby backyard, and I ran into the open front door of this random house, sobbing with no shoes on, makeup running down my face, and a welt on my head that was already becoming a bruise. I staggered into the living room, and there sat about 8 Breaking Bad-looking huge Hispanic gang members. They had bandanas and tattoos. They were not fucking around. And they definitely did not want me there. I begged them to let me use the phone to call my friend and promised I'd then leave. Naturally, they made me promise not to call the cops. I heard Dan screaming for me through the screen door, and at that moment I realized that being with the gang felt infinitely more safe than being with Dan did. But I quickly understood that my presence threatened to get them caught doing whatever it was they were doing. Some of the guys went outside to try to get Dan to leave, but he was causing a real commotion and standing his ground. I ran outside to get him to quiet down, and he got into a fistfight with one of the gang members until his eye and lip were bleeding. As the guy was pounding Dan with his fist, I instantly switched teams and began to defend Dan. When you are an abuse victim, your logic and instinct can become warped like this. It was similar to the night in high school when I realized Jeff was helping himself to my virginity, and I ended up comforting him for hurting me, even though it should have been the other way around. Here I was defending another guy who was actively betraying me. "Get off him," I yelled, running toward Dan, who was taking a serious beating. The gang members kicked us both off their property, fearing the cops would come. We walked to his car in silence. Dan had seemingly calmed down. He was even laughing a little, talking about how crazy the night had been. And so I did too. I wanted to comfort him and make him feel like we were in this together. We got into the car, and I drove the 15 minutes home. The events had sobered me right up. I tried to keep him calm. That was my only goal. He mentioned ordering food when we got home, and I let him know in a very collected, kind way that I wasn't going to stay at our apartment that night. And there it was again. The beast reawakened right before my eyes. The same beast I'd seen earlier that night, but this time it was much angrier. He started banging his head against the window and screaming. He took my hand and used it to punch himself in the face. He broke the side mirror with his own hand, and I was scream-crying, begging, pleading him to stop. I agreed to sleep at home if he'd stop hurting himself. It was a bad idea to negotiate with him like that, because what came after I agreed to sleep at home was so much worse. When we got home, I went inside and got right into bed. I was exhausted and just wanted the night to be over. I had nothing left. I begged him to leave me alone so I could sleep, but he kept tormenting me, sitting and staring at me. He shook the bed to scare me, saying, "I don't want you to go to sleep." I told him we'd talk in the morning, but I really needed to rest. I told him that if he wouldn't let me sleep, I was going to leave. He was quiet for a couple of minutes. I closed my eyes, and then opened them again to see him standing over me, staring. I told him that was it, and got up to leave. He ran to the kitchen and broke a mug, not a glass, a mug, over his head. Then started banging his head on a light fixture attached to the ceiling. It wouldn't break. I was screaming for him to stop when he grabbed a huge butcher knife from a drawer. And that's when I was sure he was going to kill me. It may sound cliche, but I saw my life flash before my eyes. I thought, this is how I die? I can't believe it. I thought about my sister and my mom finding out this was how I'd checked out. This thought awoke the beast in me. This was my moment of clarity. I had to get away from him, fast. I threw a glass against the wall as a diversion and raced out the door, running through our apartment complex, banging on all the doors, begging for someone to let me in. It was just like American Psycho, him chasing me and gaining on me at every turn. I knocked on 5 different unanswered doors before one opened up, and I flung myself inside, locking the door behind me. Dan immediately started pounding on the door. I looked up at the elderly man who'd let me in and said, "Thank you so much. I need to call the police." I'd seen this guy around the complex for months, mostly shuffling to the dumpster and back, and we'd wave once in a while. He had a bushy mustache and eyebrows that were salt and pepper colored like his hair. He looked like a cartoon. It was the second stranger's house I'd entered that night. I remember thinking to myself, how much worse can it get than the Latin King's headquarters? It was worse. I breathed the air in the apartment, and it was stale and vaguely smelled like sewage. I noticed that his wife, whom I'd never seen before, was in a hospital bed near the window. Her arms and legs had been amputated, and her mouth was cocked open, head to one side. I still don't know if she was alive or not, but I think so. It was a terrifying and disorienting scene. I went to the bathroom, which was full of furniture and filth, locked myself inside with their phone. I called a cab and stayed in there until it arrived. I walked outside, numb, when the cab pulled up. Dan was still out there, but he'd calmed down, too. I could have called the cops on him. I could have pressed charges, but I didn't want to. I felt bad for him, seeing him standing there alone. I worried about how he'd feel the next day. Even after all Dan had put me through, I couldn't dream of having him arrested. But I did finally see my situation for what it was, a case of domestic abuse. I was finally able to empathize with the millions of other women who'd been in this same situation. I was them, and they were me. I took the cab to the house of a couple that I knew. They let me sleep upstairs, and the guy of the couple slept next to their front door with a bat, which I'm still very grateful for. I flew back to New York the next day, still worried about Dan and how he might be feeling. I knew he'd feel awful and lonely and would be in a lot of pain. But I was choosing to live. I thought a lot about my sister and how I wanted to be the kind of person who made her proud. I couldn't face her if I stayed another day with a man I believed would eventually kill me. The next awful chapter of this story, and something that it pains me to tell you, is that we got back together one more time after that. During the New York City blackout of 2003, in that heat I would have fucked a salamander. It wasn't for very long, but the loneliness of New York City and my feelings for him weakened me. I think I reunited with him because I still longed to be close to him, and I wanted to punish him for hurting me so much in the past. I thought I could do more damage from the inside. I was his girlfriend, which meant I had free rein to criticize him and point out why he was the worst. I'm not proud of that, but there was a part of me that wanted to be with him again so I could hurt him back. We finally broke up a few months later and said goodbye to each other one morning when I was fully able to see him for who he really was. I could see that he presented to the world the facade of a certain kind of man who wasn't really there. He had the poster, but he couldn't name one Dexter Gordon album. He said he loved me, but every step of the way he'd hurt and sabotage me. I realized later that he put me down so much because he was probably terrified that I'd realize he was nothing and leave him, which is exactly what I did. I'm telling this story because I'm a strong-ass woman, not someone most people picture when they think abused woman. But it can happen to anyone. When you're in love with a man who hurts you, it's a special kind of hell, yet one that so many women have experienced. You're not alone if it's happening to you, and you're not exempt if it hasn't happened to you yet. I found my way out and will never be back there again. I got out. Get out. Things that make me insanely furious. 1. People who run down mountains. Have you ever been hiking and had someone run past you downhill? I secretly root for them to tumble to their, as far as I'm concerned, timely death. 2. Girls with their hair down at the gym. Unless you're covering horrible burn marks, like that girl from The Craft, pull that shit up in a ponytail. 3. Couples working out together are vile. You can't spend 1 hour apart. Also, the guy showing the submissive girl how to do everything makes me wretch. 4. People who act like the mayor of the fucking gym. I don't even smile at people I know at the gym because all I want to do is leave the whole time. If I make eye contact with someone I know and they look away immediately, I know they are a great person and I feel very close to them. 5. Apparently the gym and all forms of exercise, based on the first 4 items on this list. 6. Also, people named Jim because it sounds like the word gym. 7. People who misspell the word your when telling me I'm fat. You're fat. Y-O-U-R. 8. People who stand too close to you while you're in line for something. Make like Onyx and back the fuck up. I wish everyone was a football field away at all times, but I understand this is impossible. So please, just give me 6 inches, but 12 would be great. No penis puns here. 9. Clear-cut mail-order bride situations where the guy is disgusting and the woman is beautiful and seems trapped. I pray that these women find a way to steal the man's money and run off with it. 10. Radio commercials. Every single one ever. 11. People who say, I eat to live, I don't live to eat. I wish all 10 plagues upon your house. 12. Guys who don't make sure the girl comes. 13. Really drunk people. You may be thinking, Amy, you fucking hypocrite, but I'm not. I love drinking, but I almost never get fucking hammered anymore. Not much anyway, since college. Even when I would black out in college, no one ever knew. My speech was just a little slurred. 14. Okay, you were right. Number 13 was fucked up for me to say. I do get drunk. But still, you shouldn't. 15. Watercress. 16. People who look up, like at the ceiling, when they talk. Unless a pigeon has flown onto a chandelier above my head, look down here. 17. Also, birds inside. Any bird in an airport or mall or anything makes me out of my mind crazy furious. 18. Selective outrage. 19. Drivers who floor it when a light turns green and then brake hard at a red light. I lie to a lot of Uber drivers and tell them I'm pregnant so they will drive safer. They don't know I'm not, and really neither do I. I guess I could be. 20. The Big Bang Theory. The TV show, not the theory. 21. People who judge me as a sinner. Fuck you. 22. Hotel room deodorizers. They plug in these huge machines that make all the rooms smell the same, and it's all like baby powder and funerals. It makes your eyes water and your skin itch. 23. People who talk too loud in public. I have yelled at strangers. I will say, shh, and no one is exempt. I once shushed Vin Diesel. 24. People with egos that don't let them acknowledge the truth. 25. Black jelly beans. Also, black licorice makes me mad, but not furious. 26. House music. It is the worst. I love going out and dancing to hip-hop, but it's almost impossible to find a place that plays it anymore because they have all been replaced by this horrible excuse for music. 27. Celebrity DJs and bad boy chefs. Questlove doesn't count. He is a drummer and an amazing DJ. 28. Grown women wearing jean shorts that are small enough to be a diaper, because I can't come close to being able to rock them. I need a denim burka at this point. 29. Talking to anyone I don't know on an elevator. I guess this counts as small talk, which I've mentioned several times as something I detest. But it's even more unbearable in an elevator, because you're trapped. 30. People who go to Starbucks to write. Yuck. 31. People who bring a book to a bar deserve to be stoned. Don't try to look mysterious and interesting. You are reading in a bar. 32. People who eat impeccably healthy. Fuck you. 33. Most kids who aren't my niece. Some kids are cute, but most need to tone it right on down. 34. Guys who try to flirt with you, even though you give clear motherfucking indicators that you are not interested. Just stop. 35. Girls who act like prudes. We've all had to clean cum off our skin while making eye contact with ourselves in the mirror. 36. Guys who don't like to have sex a lot. At least twice a week, or get out of here. I know I should be sympathetic, but I have no patience for that. Athletes and musicians. I recently came into contact with the hugest dick you can imagine. And when I say hugest dick, I mean largest penis. I don't mean he was a dick, but I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me back up and properly introduce this as the chapter where I will tell you in major detail about hooking up with a few athletes and a musician. I am telling you because I think you may find it interesting. And also because even though we all know there is no holy grail of a person who will finally be the key to our everlasting confidence, because we are all just damaged little children, we still hope that someone who is killer with a guitar or puck will hold the key to eternal self-love at the tip of their tip. No? Just me? Well, read along anyway. I will not name names. Right now, maybe you're thinking, fuck you, Amy, I bought this stupid book and I want to know who these dudes are. I hear you. I want to tell you so bad. It makes it a lot funnier having a face and name go along with these terribly disappointing tales, but I can't do that. It's not a legal matter. It's just that I would personally like to have more sex in my life. And what guy in his right mind would get down with me if he knew he and his penis might end up in my next book? Also, if we ever meet in person, I'll probably tell you the actual names of these athletes and musicians. But in the meantime, let's start with the first athlete I hooked up with, who was a lacrosse player, of all sports. I'd been going through a particularly lonely time. As I write that, I realize every single one of the hookups mentioned in this chapter was a direct response to a breakup. I've learned the lesson that the grieving process after a breakup will not be sped up by hooking up with someone else. The way I usually advise my friends is by saying, it's going to take time. Let's just watch movies and go on long walks. But I don't tend to follow my own advice. I also sometimes tell a good girlfriend, you need to have sex with someone. Are you noticing a pattern that I am a hypocrite and a flake? Anyway, about this lacrosse player. We were both newly single, and he was better looking than me, and from a wealthy family. But he could apparently stomach fucking me, which is literally how it felt when we had sex. I was funnier and smarter than him, but that didn't matter to me at the time. What mattered in that moment was that he was cute and he had a working penis. We went on a couple dates, which had all the excitement of watching toenail polish dry on a cadaver. During dinner, I felt the way you always hear men supposedly feel when women are talking. I was enduring it, pretending to laugh at his jokes, letting him ask me a lot of lame questions you'd expect to hear during a job interview, such as, where do you see yourself in 5 years? He asked if I could have lunch with anyone living or dead, who would it be? I answered Mark Twain, to which he said, no, it has to be someone real. And still, without even thinking twice, I went home with him. When we kissed, there was absolutely no chemistry, which confirmed our mutual lack of interest in one another. And yet, from sheer muscle memory, our bodies were still able to have intercourse. I think we hooked up a few times before our different levels of attractiveness and senses of humor caught up to us, and he called to tell me that he'd started seeing someone else. I was shocked that he felt our few unappealing hookups obligated him to notify me he was off the market. I said, I understand, in as serious a tone as I could muster. We truly did a great job of wasting each other's time. The next athlete was in the NFL, which means he played football. This time I went to the city he lived in, and he came to my hotel. We'd been out 3 or 4 times, but hadn't hooked up yet, and this was going to be the night. He got to my room, and we had a drink, and I could already feel I didn't want this. I said I was exhausted and needed to go to sleep, and when he kissed me, I just wasn't feeling it. Our chemicals didn't mesh well together. That has happened a couple times in my life, where the kiss just doesn't taste right. It's nothing personal, just science. He grabbed my ass and kissed me, and I stopped him and said goodnight. I made some excuses about why I couldn't hang out with him until he stopped asking. Another athlete I dated was the famous professional wrestler I met on Twitter. I know you're probably thinking this would be a good moment to trash wrestling, but I've no interest in doing that. This guy was a true athlete. He was healthier, stronger, and more disciplined than most people who play a sport involving a ball or uniform. When I met him, I had no interest in wrestling, though I had spent time pretending to like it for guys in the past. See chapter titled How I Lost My Virginity. But once I saw professional wrestling behind the scenes, I was amazed by the athleticism and theater of it. Anyway, we met when I was doing a show in Phoenix, Arizona. I was alone in my nice hotel and decided to order some crab cakes. I know what you're thinking. Landlocked Arizona is world famous for its killer seafood and surfing. But I convinced myself it was a low-carb option, even though we know that outside Baltimore, Maryland, crab cakes are 99% bread. Turns out there was enough actual crab in these cakes for me to get the most violent food poisoning you can imagine. I quickly went from being completely healthy and fine to being a convulsing vessel of foul bodily fluid spouting from every orifice of my body. A couple times I had to decide between sitting on the toilet and bending over it to puke. It was a real Sophie's choice of human waste. Spoiler alert, there is no happy ending. Despite my predicament, I was still convinced I was going to perform that night. I was especially excited because the cute wrestler was going to be in the audience, and so was comedian David Spade. I wound up lying on the floor of the bathroom in my own puke with the club owner and his kind mother standing over me. I was hallucinating from dehydration, and an ambulance was called. Luckily, David Spade is a hero, and he did the show for me that night. It's the only show I've ever had to cancel from illness. I once lost my voice in the middle of a set at Governor's Comedy Club on Long Island, but I still didn't leave the stage. Since my mom and I both know sign language, I signed my entire set to her so she could deliver it to the crowd. So that night in Phoenix, I ended up having an overnight stay at the hospital. My very kind friend Jackie, who was working with me that weekend, spent the night sitting in a chair next to my hospital bed. When I woke up, I learned that I'd been inundated with countless messages on Twitter that mentioned the wrestler. Turns out the wrestler had led a campaign among his followers to get me to follow him. He had about 1 million followers, and it felt like I got a tweet from each and every one of them. He had been at the show I missed, so he knew I'd been hospitalized. As I sat there waiting to be released from the hospital, I clicked follow on his page and wrote him a direct message. Okay, I'm following you. What do you want? He wrote back, Hi, how are you feeling? He was really sweet and offered to pick me up from the hospital. In addition to this very kind gesture, the wrestler was really easy on the eyes, and I figured probably hands. So we started talking and made plans to meet up. We met in Denver, had a nice weekend together, and actually began seeing each other a few weeks later. We did our best to date, despite the fact that we were both on the road all the time, and I was still in love with my ex. I once even asked him if I could take a short dating hiatus from him to go to Mexico with my ex, and then resume our dating when I returned. He rightfully told me no. I realized that was an insane request, but I sometimes forget that a man may actually have real feelings for me. He was so physically perfect, smart, funny, and kind, but I remember being in some hotel with him, seeing his knee pads drying on the radiator, and thinking I was in the wrong story. Naturally, I got back together with my ex, always a great idea. The wrestler and I are still good friends, and I'll be very happy for whatever lucky lady ends up with him. Even though he's a recent ex, and I usually wish rare Amazonian skin diseases on their new girlfriends. Which brings me to the musician. The musician was probably the saddest experience of all. He's famous, and I'm a fan. I would never have ever, ever, ever thought he'd be interested in me. Any of these guys, actually. These are dudes who have access to tiny models. But what I've learned is that guys are guys, no matter how famous or hot, and they basically all want to hook up with anyone they're even moderately attracted to who will hold still long enough for them to rub against them. Does that sound like an insult? Because it's actually something that I love about men so much. I love the simplicity of the drive they have to fuck. Their biology is so beautiful to me. We ladies work so hard to be attractive for them, and we really don't need to. Their driving force is to put their penises in our buttholes. Meanwhile, I'm worried if he can see the roots of my highlights. I have thoughts like, should I get a French manicure? He doesn't care. He wants to jam his wiener in your pooper. Anyway, I met this musician for lunch. I thought we were just friends, but he hugged me in a masterful way I will never forget. He slid his hand along my lower back, starting at my hip, inside my leather jacket. When he hugged me, I realized, oh, this is a date. We were both going through breakups, so we complained about our exes and ate ramen. We were having such a good time that we made plans to meet up later that same evening. I was very much not out of the woods with my feelings for my ex, but revenge dating a rock star seemed like a pretty good plan. We met up at the Bowery Hotel and had some drinks. Showing up to this second location for the second date in one day with this guy totally freaked me out. He was now going to be evaluating me as a woman he might want to hook up with, or date, so I of course lost all my self-esteem while I was getting dressed to meet him. I got nervous and I put too much into it. The early hangout was lunch with a friend, but this was a fucking date with a fucking rock star. He commented, "You're like a different person than you were earlier today," immediately detecting my plummeting confidence. We walked around and watched some stand-up comedy at a nearby club. I told him I'd had a great time and tried to say goodnight, but he talked me into one more drink at the hotel. The bar was closed by then, so he suggested we order drinks from room service and went up to his hotel room. By this point, I'd accepted as fact that there was no way he was attracted to me, and I figured he must have just liked hanging out with me. This is how it's been my whole life. I've always assumed that men see me as just one of the guys, so when someone is interested in me as a girl, I am floored. This hang-up has gotten better over time, but it's not completely gone. Anyway, we had a drink in his room, and when I got up to hug him goodbye, he kissed me. We didn't have good chemistry, but I was flattered. And this was the first person I'd kissed who wasn't my boyfriend in the last 4 years. So I went with it. We got in bed, we got naked, and I couldn't have been less present. It was like what I would imagine Pat Sajak feels like at this point on Wheel of Fortune. If you look deep into his eyes, he is a full-blown zombie. I could see the two of us like I was out of my body, and I felt so sad for us. A rock star and a whatever I am. But no matter who you are, you still feel all the same shit as everyone else. We both missed our exes. We didn't do much of anything. We touched each other, and tears started rolling down my cheeks. I wasn't crying, but they were just coming out. He noticed and held me. We lay there in the dark, eyes open, listening to each other breathe. I was in so much pain at the time, and I could feel his pain too. We didn't judge or want anything from each other. After he fell asleep, I slipped out of the room. I'm grateful he was so sweet and as sad as I was too. I felt less alone for a couple moments, and I'm sure I was the most disappointing hookup of his life, which I'm actually a little proud to say. It's good to stand out, even in that way. He will never forget me. I'm now seeing a real pattern in these stories. I have been a huge disappointment to hook up with. I've always thought of myself in these hookups as the one who was shortchanged by a bummer guy, but upon further reflection, it seems like it really was me who was the bummer. Interesting. Oh well, no time to unpack that. On to the huge cock. I want to preface this story by saying I have no interest in hockey. I have gone to a couple games and had fun. But that's mostly because I went with my sister, and we gave ourselves fake bruises. We only went to Rangers games at Madison Square Garden, and I'd wear a neck brace and two black eyes and put Band-Aids all over Kim. I don't know why we used to do that, but we liked to look like we had gotten all bloodied. Most people would ignore us and look away as quickly as possible, but some people would ask what happened, and we would say we got into a thing with each other. Kim and her husband love hockey, and they always talk about one of their favorite players. They love how he plays and are always mentioning that he's funny and cool off the ice, too. They bring up this dude all the time with me. He followed me on Twitter, so I followed him back. And when I told my sister he was following me, she flipped out. She was like, "You have to message him. You would love each other." So I did. I told him he was my favorite player, and I think I said if he ever wanted to come see a stand-up show to let me know. He showed me enough respect not to pretend to be interested in seeing a comedy show, and instead asked me if I wanted to get a drink. I said yes, and was very excited that Kim would think I was the shit. She never does. On the day of our date, I went to the location we'd agreed on and waited for nearly 40 minutes. He was texting me saying, "Sorry, leaving soon." I left the place angry but got a text shortly after telling me that he was very sorry and that he would meet me anywhere I wanted. I made him go to Fat Cat, a basement bar in the Village that has jazz music and ping pong. When I arrived and saw him across the room, I realized he was with all of his friends. So I was now on a group date with a bunch of rowdy guys. I was yelling over the music and trying to communicate with him, but we had all the rapport of the Pope and Rick Ross. We didn't know what to talk about, couldn't hear each other, and didn't understand each other's sarcasm. I finally gave up and started talking to his friends. They were treating me like some whore that their famous athlete friend was going to bang, which, in their defense, was what I was. Except I didn't have the patience to stick it out. So when he told me that they were going to another bar, I said I wasn't and started to say farewell to my sister's favorite athlete. He said, "Well, no, I'll just go with you then." I was shocked. He didn't even say goodbye to his friends. We went to one more bar on the way home, and I watched him play a dumb golf arcade game and listened to him discuss his dreams and his family. I couldn't believe I was going to hook up with this beautiful, tall, talented guy whom I could barely understand or connect with. He was using hockey terms, thinking I was a huge fan, but I'd only been to a few games in my life and understood nothing. He asked me exactly zero questions about myself, and that was the perfect amount. I wasn't interested in building a future with this guy. I was just sticking around to see if he'd be willing to hook up with me. Even though in my eyes, we were a physical mismatch on the level of Miss Piggy and Charles Grodin in The Great Muppet Caper, or Kate Hudson and anyone I've ever seen her paired up with. I often feel this way with men who have been willing to be physical with me. Fortunately, most men are driven toward a wet hole more than a perfect face, especially late at night. We went to his apartment, and he put on the TV show Workaholics and went down on me right away. I thought he was such a sweetheart for doing that. I came thinking he was a prince. But then I saw the reason for his chivalry. He took his dick out, and I became a cartoon. My jaw hit the floor, which coincidentally was the only way his dick was going to fit in there. I have a small mouth, and the size of this hog was like nothing I'd ever seen. No way was that going near my vagina. I felt like a musician performing on the deck of the Titanic, knowing there was nothing I could do but go down. I felt like I was trying to fit an entire Thanksgiving turkey in a toilet paper roll. Not happening. He tried to act like his dick wasn't that big, as if it were a normal size and I was just being skittish and weird. But after several attempts, I determined I could not fellate this fellow. Feeling badly, I tried to be a team player and said we could give sex a go. I lay back and tried to think of a more relaxing environment, like Guantanamo Bay, or the shoe display at the Holocaust Museum, but it wasn't going to happen. He encouraged me to try to make it fit, to which I said, "I'm not going to try to force it in and deform my pussy just so I can have sex with you once. Sorry, bro. I'd rather not have to pick up my NuvaRing off the subway platform because it keeps falling out of my new gaping vag, courtesy of your endless BFG of a cock." I was making him laugh, and this was clearly not his first rodeo, with a girl chanting, "Hell no, water buffalo." So we did the only classy thing we could do. We made out while I jerked him off in my general direction. When he came, it landed mostly on my stomach. I got up to clean myself off, and he said, "Where are you going? You got a mess on you." And he went to get me a warm washcloth and a dry one. I then watched this member of the NHL clean me very carefully. Maybe he was afraid I'd try to steal his DNA like a hip-hop wife. But it was the sweetest thing to witness. He looked like a little boy working on a science project. I got dressed, and he seemed legitimately confused and sad that I was leaving. He asked if I would stay and watch a movie, and when we would see each other again. I felt like we were starring in two different movies. I explained that I had a great time with him, and that we would never see each other again. I did the walk of shame at 4:30 a.m., You may be recalling an earlier chapter where I told you I've only had one one-night stand in my life, and thinking this counts as number two. But I don't consider it a one-night stand unless sex occurred. Sex where a penis enters your vagina or butthole. Why don't I write romance novels? My prose is so arousing. I called my sister in the morning from a Starbucks and told her what had happened, and we both laughed so hard we were crying. I'd only gone out with him so she'd think I was cool. And that is definitely not what happened. She thought it was the saddest thing she'd ever heard. We still laugh to tears whenever he takes the ice. Does that sound mean? Did you have a moment reading this story where you felt bad for him? Please don't. Please don't shed any tears for this rich, famous, and perfect-looking athlete with a huge cock. He's just fine. He has no doubt had many wonderful sexual experiences aside from with me. He's now married to a gorgeous, tiny woman, and whenever I see pictures of them, I think, good luck with that, sweetheart. Letter to the editor. I've always been a sucker for magazines, even the ones that tell me I am doing everything wrong as a woman. I grew up covering my bedroom walls with magazine photos of Jason Priestley and Luke Perry. I'd steal Redbook from my mom and Mademoiselle from my dad. Haha, just kidding. My dad didn't read Mademoiselle, but I thought writing that would create a good, funny rhythm. Amy, stop explaining your jokes and get on with it. I buy and flip through tabloids, which I believe causes cancer. I'll also buy a Time magazine if I feel like looking like a genius. And I put it on top of the stack so if anyone sees me, they think, what a smart, important girl. I wonder what's under that. Newsweek? The Economist? I can't think of any other smart magazines, which lets you know I'm Long Island trash who came close to not graduating high school. Anyway, I like magazines on a flight or when I'm laying out on the beach hungover. I've never thought too hard about them. And I definitely never, ever imagined that I'd actually be in them, much less see my face slapped on the cover. My first few appearances in magazines were as a writer. After I'd been doing stand-up for a few years, I started receiving offers to write funny articles for women's magazines. I wrote for Cosmo a couple times, and it was really fun. I wrote about things similar to what I'm covering in this book. So when I was asked to write an article for Men's Health magazine, I was fired up. I pride myself on being a comic who appeals to both men and women. So I was excited to get exposure in a dude's periodical as well. I met with Ryan, an editor of sorts for the magazine. He was 45 minutes late to our meeting, never a good sign, but he was really apologetic and complimentary of my stand-up, so of course, all was forgiven. We got down to business and brainstormed what I'd write about. Sex. My cup of tea. All good in the hood. Ryan and I started discussing the photo to go along with my article. I had some concepts I thought were pretty funny. Me holding a copy of the magazine with a front cover that read, The Daddy Issue, or me dressed as a sad stripper next to a No Jokes in the Champagne Room sign. Ryan laughed at my sick ideas and said he'd pass them along to the art department. Over the next month and a half, we settled on the finished piece. A few weeks later, I was backstage getting ready to film the stand-up portion of my pilot for Comedy Central when I got an email from Ryan putting me in touch with the fact-checker about one last sidebar. And that's when I saw the layout of the article. It was accompanied by three huge pictures, and I couldn't help but notice that none of them was me. Each one featured a very slender, heavy-titted model whose age ranged from old enough for military service to too young to rent a car. Minutes later, I had to go on stage in front of cameras under bright-ass lights and tell jokes that were supposed to be funny and empowering. But all I wanted to do was throw in the towel and switch to the path that Men's Health obviously saw for me. This path probably involved writing in a broom closet for the rest of my life or standing at the bottom of a hole putting lotion on my skin that they dropped down in a bucket for me. Or at least that's how they made me feel. I could just hear them saying, Schumer's a very fun girl. Bright. With a face for podcasting. I emailed Ryan and asked about the pictures, and his reply was something along the lines of, Sorry, it wasn't my call. Now's the time we really need you to sign off on that sidebar. I was brushed off. And even though I can imagine everyone at Men's Health shaking their heads and saying, Ugh, just another crazy homely woman creating problems because she's not hot enough, I told him I wouldn't do any more work until I got some answers. So Ryan, who was a really nice guy, just doing his job probably, put me in touch with the editor, a man I'll call Jake. And here's the reply I got. Hey, Amy, just read your note to Ryan, and I apologize if there's been any confusion over the art treatment for your story. In fact, we very rarely run author images with any story, and that applies equally to Amy Schumer and Jonathan Safran Foer and Jesse Eisenberg and Augustine Burroughs and Garrison Keillor. All well-known names, all people we turn to for wit, intelligence, and nicely turned phrases, but not for photo shoots, so you're in very good company among the non-photographed. When I heard your complaint, though, I winced a little. I hate for any of our contributors to be smarting over a detail of their piece. So we've hunted down a good photo of you. You're right, there are plenty. And I've incorporated it into the spread so everybody knows who wrote this and can congratulate you when they see you on the street or marquee. Please accept my apologies. Now, you want to write a funny essay about double standards in male beauty and female beauty? Game on. Many thanks for the sweet piece. In any case, our guys are going to love it. Best, Jake. Jake, I appreciate your response. That's certainly an impressive